Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yo!
Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends, and a pleasant Cyber Monday to you.
Digital bleep blobs to you too, sir.
Happy cybering.
Totally not cyber.
Yes.
All man, all real, all the time, Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Bleep bloop. Hello.
Nope. I am
organic. ASL. Okay. ASL.
So we're gonna start off with the I'm gonna pontificate on things that I know nothing about and have only half-assed opinions about. So Bryce sent a article to us, and I just scanned it, and I'm like, are we talking about? I'm like, Justin had more information on this, so I'll let you lead, Justin.
All right. Well, I'm going to also preface this by saying I have not read the article beyond the first couple paragraphs. However,
I have read the article.
We can bring it up. We can summarize. Actually, no, Bryce, I'm assuming you did read.
I have read the article. I can briefly go over.
Well, then, for more on this, we go to our reporter in the field, Bryce.
So, Thrillist.com ran a piece from Kevin Alexander titled "I Found the Best Burger Place in America and Then I Killed It." The long and short of it is that Kevin went on a search to eat at hundreds of different burger places around the country and then name one of them the best burger in America for Thrillist. And he landed on Stanich's, a burger shop in Oregon. And not but a few weeks, possibly months later, the owner had gotten in touch and basically said, well, you just destroyed my restaurant. And the burger shop closed down, and they had a sign, oh, we'll be reopening, you know, in late 2018. And the author goes to, like, he talks a little bit to some of his other food reviewer buddies on what.
How did he destroy them?
Well, I'll get to that. Part of the story is him talking to other critics about what they think their role is in terms of ranking and displaying, reviews about a place and the sometimes great force that comes along with those of, you know, hammering restaurants that aren't equipped for that capacity or bringing out non-local people. He makes the journey back to Steve Stanich's burger shop and it definitely sounds like there are more personal issues that went into play with the burger shop shutting down. But a lot of it is also is catalyzed by being crowned this, you know, best burger in America and constantly, you know, being further overworked and trying to meet the capacity of becoming a tourist spot.
I guess they got too busy, Brian, and so that wreaked havoc with the delicate nature of the business, eventually tearing it asunder.
Oh, well, it just sounds like it was a poorly run operation that couldn't handle stress. Like if you have a well run operation, then it should scale, and then you have more money to spend on more things.
Well, that's easy to say, but there's like a human element to it, right? Like it maybe it was a bad business that couldn't scale, but that also, like, they just because that business couldn't scale doesn't mean it was bad at its
Let me just my issue is, like, I read the, you know, the guy saying, yeah, I killed it, and it was sort of like, it was like ego stroking, like, yeah, like, I'm, you know, I did this, woe is my power. And I'm like, you know, yes, you have this ability to bring a lot of traffic there, and you did that. Businesses succeed and fail all the time. And there's other articles that came out that are like, there were some personal issues at why he shut it down. It wasn't because he had too much business or this. There was other reasons there. But if you're a reporter and you're the center of this, you want to write like, yeah, I killed it. Sorry, did I? And it's like, maybe there's more to it, like the business structure. Because like, there are lots of businesses that succeeded wonderfully because of the attention brought to it. And that was sort of my issue here, is that it's like, oh, did I kill it by praise? And it's like,
well, let's look at it on this side, because I will criticize this article because I think there's a tremendous amount that you can criticize. However, it is kind of the observer's dilemma, right? Like, are you affecting it by observing it? If you know, there are two timelines, and we don't know one, which is how long would that business have gone if there had been no article written about it? Would it have gone for longer? Would he have been happier? We don't know, but we do know that he blames on some level this article for, you know, even if it was going to eventually close, but it would have closed 5 years from now, possibly. Instead, it closed within 3 months. Is there an observer's guilt to possibly creating that faster timeline?
I don't know. How much of the article is him just, you know, bemoaning the power to destroy worlds?
I think it's, and Bryce can fill it in, but from what my understanding of the article, it's a little bit more of a larger meditation on what these kinds of listicles and designations can do to what is, no matter what, a very fragile business. Restaurants are intensely fragile just in general. They go down all the time for a million different reasons. Now, normally, and this is to the criticism, people are too excited about my business is fairly rare amongst the reasons why my business shut down, unless it is just another thing that exacerbates the hole in the bucket of a million different personal reasons, up to and including family problems and yeah, divorces and substance abuse. I mean, all these things in the small business of a restaurant, which has very, very high overhead in general, can be exacerbated by success. But the one thing you want that you are desperate, like, there are a million restaurants that have amazing food and a great wait staff and everything that you would ever want that die on the vine within months because it's not in the right place and it just doesn't get the kind of traffic that it was hoping for, and it can't get off, it can't make it off the runway, and it dies very quickly.
So
rare is it that it's like, oh no, too many.
So here's partially how it's described. After my story came out, crowds of people started coming into the restaurant, people in from out of town or from the suburbs, basically non-regulars. And as the line started to build up, his employees, who were mainly family members, got stressed out, and the stress would cause them to not be as friendly as they should be or to shout out crazy long wait times for burgers in an attempt to maybe convince people to leave. And as it started happening, things fell to the wayside. Dishes weren't cleared quickly, new people weren't having the proper sandwiches experience, and Steve would spend his entire day going around apologizing and trying to fix things. They may pay him lip service to face, but they were never coming back, so they had no problem going to Yelp or Facebook and denouncing the restaurant and saying the burgers were bad.
Okay, now it makes a little bit more sense. So he was digging on his sleepy diner experience and the regulars and the enjoying the quiet pastoral Americana of running a burger shop, and that was taken from him with this spotlight of attention and the changing of expectations of everybody showing up at his doorstep. And even if, you know, from the outside, you could say, well, first thing you do is you raise the price of the burger and then you hire more staff or whatever. But then it's becoming something different than what he wanted to run. And he got to that decision gate where he's like, well, I'd rather just not run it.
I would say that there was something in there that we kind of glossed over, which was, who was the staff?
Oh, his family, yeah.
Family.
Yeah. Ah, ding ding. I think they probably, what he wanted, what they wanted. The fact that his family, they said this family was actively working against the best interests of the place there, the false times, things like this, that was disregarding the customer base. That's the allusions I read elsewhere, like there was more going on behind the scenes. I think that might be a case where it's like,
I'll continue describing some of this. So that partially explains why they closed. They were going to only close for 2 weeks to sort of clean up, to do, I guess, deep cleaning. quote, he started to explain why it wasn't just 2 weeks. He asked me not to reveal the details of that story, but I can say that they were personal problems, the type of serious things that can happen with any family and would have happened regardless of how crowded Stanich's was, and that real life is always more complicated and messier than we want it to be. So there's definitely like other things outside of this one article happening, but...
And that when Nate Silver had alluded to that, and thus the kerfuffle where he was saying, hey, if you look at the Yelp, because Nate, you know, let's look at the data before the review and let's look at the Yelp reviews. The same problems existed before. You know, they had the same complaints about the staff, the same complaints about wait times and stuff, about even was empty waiting forever for food and stuff like this. And it's a thing we've heard before. Money or success magnifies.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a bit like turning up the contrast on an old mm-hmm. television. You know, it's like all of a sudden it just if there are dark splotches or trouble spots, they will get much harder and darker.
Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately, I think, the problem there is that, you know, there are no shortages of places around my neck of the woods that are, you know, 4-5 table restaurants, and they don't accept reservations, and people will wait for many, many hours to get in and have an intimate experience between the cook and the customer, and they will not blame the restaurant for its success. They will just be happy that they either showed up early enough to not wait all that long, or understand that this is what happens when you go to a restaurant like this. I don't think that that was necessarily off the table. What I do think is, man, having worked in and around the restaurant industry for a fair portion of my life, you know, the average restaurant crew, from owner to operators to the employees, are far more like a construction staff than they are artisans. And it is a very hard business. It is a very stressful business. And sometimes the folks that start it, you know, something goes wrong. Like, things can go wrong very, 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 very fast in the restaurant business. You know, your overhead, because it is so high, can put you underwater very, very quickly. It doesn't sound like this business was equipped for success.
So what was when he closed their doors, and I guess he still owns the place, and it's going to be under a different name with the same burger recipe or whatever?
Well, it is closed. He's still paying rent on it, yes. But whether he is going to partner with someone else or reopen it is, as of this article, seemingly undecided.
Running a small business that has to scale is challenging. You know, as a kid, I worked for a costume shop, Annie's Costumes and Magic in Plantation, Florida. And, you know, when most of the year it was a, you know, small shop, and then come Halloween, it was one of the only games in town as far as costumes and stuff, and business was out the door. It was insane. And if you were an employee there, you know, you had to work these crazy mad hours, and you might be kind of a little, you know, disgruntled because you're like, you know, we're doing all this work for these people. But then it's like, the owners were always wonderful. I mean, they're great. But the other side of it is like, they got to pay the rent on this thing the rest of the year. They've got to run this thing, you know, year round, and they have all these other obligations. And, you know, kind of that was, for me, it was a very interesting observation of labor versus management. Was, you know, labor, I see, I'm doing all this at this time, but then I have to step back and go, yeah, they can't just say we're going to lease this property, you know, during September, October. You know, they have to do this year round, and they have to go out and do these buys at these costume shows, you know, like a year in advance, and all these other things that I started to appreciate what goes on to this and how hard these things are, from dealing with supply, demand, labor, all these other stuff. And so anyhow, I guess my point is that's, you know, a lot of the stuff that kind of goes on behind the scenes is you just, well, I want this thing, here's the thing, and then we're done, you know. And, you know, you don't have to see how naive people are about this when you're waiting in line. And let's say a fast food place, and there's only two people behind the counter, and you watch somebody go yell at one of those two people as if they were the person that decided to only have two people working there that day.
Right. You
know?
Yeah.
I mean, I see it. It just drives me. It's like, you know, these, it's not their choice. You know, there's more going on here, but I guarantee you the person taking your order is not the one that decided, you know, this would be the situation.
Yeah. Now, let's get into this. The fact that self-flagellation is something that is all over an article like this, and that we can all now feel we can all feel guilty together that yes, it is the food writer who issued the death sentence to this poor restaurant, and it is us, the foodie, that reads such lists and then goes out of their way to support these businesses. That was the executioner that swung the axe and killed it. Like, there is a very reliable kind of journalism in the modern era that is about woe is us. And this is the double dose of it. The writer feeling bad about his own hand in it, and the readers sympathetic to the crowds that would go make a trip to go find the best burger in America, now feeling, oh, I don't know, is this good? Am I doing a good thing when I go out of my way to find the things that Thrillist recommends? Like, maybe there's a natural order to how we go about restauranteering, and I shouldn't be piling on when somebody says that this is the best ramen or burger or pizza in the world, let alone the country, let alone my town.
You know, it's interesting, like, the back and forth between Nate Silver and Kevin Alexander, because it's like, you know, Nate's like, well, maybe it had to do with this, and Kevin seemed to be upset that Nate was sort of exonerating him from this.
Oh, that is interesting. Like he already came to peace with, like, well, you know, I need to be more conscientious about, you know, and recognize that I'm shining a giant spotlight that changes these businesses. And then once you have reached peace with that, to be sort of thrown back into, you just decide, like, well, that's the way it is. Finally, I don't have to agonize over whether it did the right thing or the wrong thing. I now have learned and growed and so on. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, here's an escape hatch if you want to exonerate yourself. It's like, no, I already came to peace with all of this.
Or maybe step down off your own petard. You know, maybe, you know, that's the other approach too.
Oh yeah, now you look like a big asshat for having proclaimed stuff that it, by the numbers, appears to be false.
I think that there's no doubt that, again, I think that there is a legitimate question, and I think even Nate Silver said it at the beginning of the back and forth between the two of them, that there is a really, really good article there about food journalism and about the desire to find the best and how the timelines for these things can be altered. And do we understand that, you know, does the publisher understand and does the restaurant understand that, yeah, this could turn a small problem that, you know, gosh darn it, my cousin's such a crappy waiter and, you know, we can't keep a dishwasher, man. Those are some real problems that I'm going to get to next week when you run a Sleepy Burger place. It is a major problem when now people are flaming your Yelp because the cousin that was bad with two tables is now awful with a full boat from the second they walk in to the second that they leave. But that being said, like, I mean, you didn't kill the place.
There was the and we're biased because friends work on the show, but there was this, oh, is Bar Rescue killing bars? Is Bar Rescue, you know, is it actually the death knell for a bar? And there's a piece about how some bar, you know, had Bar Rescue come in and then they closed and this very thing. But then actually there's a website, barrescueupdates.com, where they keep track of, like, the bars, and, like, you're like, you know, some close, but I would say they're probably above, you know, above the norm, statistical average there.
Well, keep in mind also, this is with the fact that they have a selection bias where they need total crap shows, like stuff hanging by a thread, people who have explosive, non-cooperative personalities. Like, they're making good television. So if anything, that you would expect that even more of them should be closing with the stress and the spotlight and all that being turned on them.
All right, now hold on. Bryce has been trying to get a word in edgewise on the story that he brought up. So Bryce, please go ahead.
No, I think back to... This is a slightly similar story. There is there was an artist online who was doing this little, like, web comic He was doing this webcomic. It was almost weekly or so, but it was the sort of thing where it was cutesy and it was, you know, quippy or whatever, so it would get shared on Reddit a lot. And the like it as a thing had kind of ballooned into this scale that the artist like did not like, right? It was way too much attention. It was kind of what everybody you would assume you would want, right? Is a lot of exposure and your name and the name of the thing to be well known. But it ended up being so much that he completely stopped working on it because all of the attention and all of the things that come with that attention, not just like people interacting with you, but also like everyone having their own opinion and letting you know it, kind of took that
like
thing away.
Here's a hypothetical. Imagine somebody shining a billion watt spotlight on Night Attack saying, "This is the single greatest comedy podcast on the planet." And then
we should have really
done
this as a weird things fantasy scenario, Brian, but go ahead.
imagine all of a sudden, like our regular viewers make up 1% of the live audience watching. And then I get the suspicion, you know, we're a bit of a bitter pill to swallow for a lot of people. We're a bit much. And then I can imagine them rioting and it suddenly not being fun for us to do, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Although we've had, I mean, listen, we don't know what it would be like to have the megawatt, right? If all of a sudden we had Serial's audience tomorrow, that would be a tremendous jump, right? But we've had jumps before. Like we've seen platform changes and we've seen new audience members come in, and it took time and we changed, the show changed, the audience melded together, and then we kind of rolled along. The point that I would like to make to Bryce's example,
sure,
is would you say that Reddit killed that comic?
Partially, yeah.
Because I think Reddit is the dumb tube. Reddit is the place where that comic's talent wound up outstretching the creator's will to do it. Mm-hmm. The comic was so good that people paid a lot of attention to it, and that was too much, too fast, and possibly too much forever, right? That they're a private person or an insecure person or any the normal things that we all have going on in our own head. I would say that's just, you know, that's just something that can happen sometimes, you know. And even then, that's an example of something with fairly little cost. That's little overhead. It's not like that author probably or that artist really had to rely on many other people except themselves and their own schedule to put out whatever they wanted. And yet still, there was an example of, all right, it got too big. Not everybody wants a scale like that.
And it's you know, especially in that anecdote, there's not any one person who can really be blamed as stabbing a knife into this thing. But I think in a larger sense, right, there will always be restaurant rankings or, you know, the bullet you the must eat places in Oregon or what have you. But I think that there's at least some value in hearing, you know, this guy who was, you know, living, breathing, eating this list for however long and had something that he was proud of go and I don't know, kill this thing that
look,
you know,
I think there is a great reporter story in, because this is a very weird thing when you are somebody that reports on something and then things change and you maintain a reporter source relationship with somebody on the inside. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. But even let's take out some of the sensational, like, I killed this, you killed this, this other thing killed this. If he goes on this big trip and congratulations, this should be an honor. This should be something that turbocharges your business. I am handing you this, you know, the keys to this success Maserati. Please drive it around as much as you want. You earned it. You created the best burger. And then that guy just says, man, we're actually doing really, really well. But now, like, things have changed between me and my wife. And things have changed between me and my kids. And I had a long lost brother that I didn't know existed that now came out of the woodwork because everybody around town knows that we're doing really well. And we're going to open up a second store. And now it's like it's made my life harder. It's made my life more complicated. And he's just, you know, doing that. There's a weird relationship between reporter and source about like, oh, geez, okay. I guess like I came in and I did a thing and now life is different. And even if somebody who, if he handled it perfect, right? Mm-hmm. And there's just, you know, look, people who win the lottery have horrifying things happen to them about, you know, going from 0 to 60 in terms of just having a bunch of money in their life.
Yeah, you know what? That's the better analogy, is not, you know, whether he killed the restaurant, but he the lottery analogy is a really good one. There's a great article. Somebody just wrote paragraphs and paragraphs about just how screwed you are when you win the lottery. I'll have to find that and link that out.
Yes, and because I used to be curious of the stories of like the horrible things that happened to people who won the lottery. But the argument is, does it say what the lottery does to you, or does it say something about people who spend the most money on lottery tickets?
Right. Yeah.
You know, and that's the other, because you hear about like, man, like, wow, this is, and it is, yeah, that everything crawls out of the rule works, but it's always like, who spends the most? And it's people already in situations where financially irresponsible, not spending anybody buys a lottery tickets financially responsible, but people who spend the most on them as a percentage of income are more likely to win because they spend that, or what group is more, you know, where do you see ads for the lottery? Poor neighborhoods, poor places like this. So it's, that's the part of it that doesn't get as much attention, is, you know, these state-run lotteries are predatory upon the poor. You know, I think they're, I have no problem with them existing, but they really are a tax on the poor, in a way, and prey upon these things. And you sort of like, you know, if they were in everybody's best interest, you'd be able to buy one ticket, but that ain't the case. But I do think the lottery example is an example of immediately you get a bunch of success all of a sudden, and now what happens? And, you know, Guy Kawasaki, in one of his books, he talked about like people worry about too much success. He thinks, I think it's a joke. I've never heard anybody fail, you know, business failing because of too much success. And I think the problem is with that is that's yes and, but if you're a company, you know, if let's say I sold some really cool custom Houdini box idea thing, okay, and I had, you know, a couple thousand of these things to sell, and then overnight I get an order for 100,000 of them. That's fantastic. But if I can only get hold of 5,000 of these, I'm going to have 95,000 people hate me. I'm going to have 95,000 people hate me. And I would say, yes, it was amazing promotion that worked wonderfully, but the inability to meet demand isn't the fault of you, you know, isn't the fault of the hypothetical person. And that's a problem. I think that like Guy Kawasaki, who I respect a lot, I'm like, no, there's issues. Like if I'm working on a website project right now and I've got to figure out scalability, because if I made an app and it made it into the iTunes store and all of a sudden everybody wants it, but my back end can only handle 1,000 users a day, mm-hmm. Right. I could be destroyed because there's been a number of businesses we stopped using, you know, because yeah, look at examples like, their service got bad, like Friendster. Why did we stop using Friendster? They couldn't scale. They had a lot of success and they couldn't scale. They had problems. And then, you know, Facebook didn't have those. And there are issues like that where you go like YouTube, you know, MySpace had too much success. They couldn't scale because the success came at a faster, popularity came at a faster rate than the infrastructure.
Hey, I've got a hard out in 10 minutes. Do you want to swing into picks?
Surely.
I went and saw that Wreck-It Ralph movie. The first act was so kind of by the numbers, which I think pays off when they start to break the traditional Disney storytelling structure and play with it a little bit more. So it took a while to warm up for me, but I really enjoyed it by the end. I thought it was good.
Groovy.
Did you feel like it was a movie only for kids, or did you think that?
No. Yeah.
So I guess the last Ralph movie came out like five or six years ago, 2012, 6 years ago. So yeah. That would be, even that audience would be significantly older.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, it's there are moments, and I'd be curious to hear what you guys think. There's at least one scene where it felt very strongly like it was a coming out same-sex attraction scene, although just different words being used. And then other scenes, you know, felt, you know, very clearly like this is a parent-child relationship, and this is what it looks like to go to college or whatever. I mean, it's a, I think there's lots and lots for adults.
It felt written for an older audience.
It felt very smart, but also obviously played for kids. And there's a few just you know really flat short gags that that cause those involuntary barks of laughter where it's just like, oh, that was, you know, it doesn't overstay the joke, just gets in and gets out. And then there's all the on the nose stuff that you would expect when it's about the internet, and you know it's very clear which internet companies were interested in playing ball and which ones weren't, and so as a result, it feels kind of consumery. And but then again, that worked for Toy Story, and I think a version of it.
Is it better or worse than the Emoji Movie?
I'm gonna say better.
Okay. My pick is. This is a very specific taste. If you're not into Norm MacDonald, you're not going to like the Norm MacDonald Has a Show on Netflix. The guests he gets are very, very good. The one episode that I will recommend is his episode with Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton is somebody that I can't believe isn't just, I don't know. He just needs to be in everything. There needs to be just another, like a Netflix series or something. He needs to get in on this prestige TV thing because Michael Keaton is just amazing.
He needs to take a break from being Batman, the Vulture, Birdman, one of the most beloved long-standing careers.
The world needs more. The world needs more of Michael Keaton. But what I did not know and is revealed in this episode is that, you know, John Lovitz's liar character?
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, that's the ticket. Apparently, wholesale ripped off from Michael Keaton's stand-up career.
What?
Really?
Like, down to the vocal inflections, and they talk about it a little bit on that episode. But and then Michael Keaton, like, does some of the act, and you're like, Oh my God. Michael Keaton's stand-up career is something that is kind of lost to history because, you know, post Beetlejuice, it was like, I'm here, bye. Like now I'm Batman. Now I'm in all these other different things. Yeah, just a great conversation. I think the best conversations on that entire show are when Norm is talking to other stand-up comics, because he's good at doing that kind of stuff. He's a very particular interviewer. He's going to ask you some things that a regular interviewer wouldn't get away with because of his delivery, but holy crap, can he meander. And sometimes even a Norm fan like myself can find myself just kind of like tapping the watch, like, can we get back to that interesting question that you had asked them, like, you know, 20 minutes ago before you got off on whatever Norm jag you got on?
I have a pick. You guys have probably already seen this. I started rewatching this because... there was some, I don't remember what show it was, but last week we were doing one of these podcasts and it was brought up, and the idea that the first seasons of this were not as good as some of the middle or later seasons, and that is Futurama. Futurama's on Hulu, so I've been going back and rewatching Futurama. Futurama holds up, y'all. I mean, see, like, it isn't until like the third and fourth seasons where they really start to do like the emotional episodes, right? Mm-hmm. Like Fry's dog is the like the first episode of season 5 or something, you know, the Cyclops,
the one where he gets stung by the bee.
That's a later one. But also you kind of need to have like a wackety schmackety character building time before you can make those emotional episodes hit. Mm-hmm. But it's a show that really holds up. And I don't know. It's, I kind of makes me want to go to like, the old seasons of The Simpsons and see how those also hold up, because I think both of these shows are reflective of their times, even though Futurama is set, you know, way in the future. The other thing that I noticed when rewatching Futurama is, and again, I don't know how much of this is a product of the times or an early... There are more like inclusions of like gay jokes and like characters of color and like non-white characters that I thought was really like refreshing and never felt like a punch down. Like they make a lot of gay jokes and they don't ever feel insulting. Mm-hmm. the way like they're, you know, from the right perspective. And I thought that was really refreshing, you know, for something that, you know, started in what, 1999,
2000? Yeah.
So I haven't gotten to like the Comedy Central ones yet. I really, the movies were okay. I didn't like them cut up into episodes. And then the season or two that they did after that, I thought was not very good, but it'll be interesting to see kind of going through all of that at once. So, that's the Futurama. It's all on Hulu.
Yeah, I love that show. The later episodes, like the Netflix ones and that, like, they felt underwritten to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have the same problem that I have a little bit with Disenchanted.
Enchanted, exactly. Yep.
Which is that it's a little too cynical and a little detached from the concept, where it's like, oh, we're kind of making modern jokes, but in this conceit, and not we're making jokes about in the conceit with modern references,
right?
So I feel like that balance sort of broke once you hit the Comedy Central period of Futurama.
And if like cartoons, it often stands out. Sometimes it feels like, yeah, this feels like one writer or two writers who wrote this, and not like or two writers in a writer's room.
Right.
And I would say that's my issue there, is it feels like that, but still, my pick. I watched last night, you know, there's the Nat Geo has the Mars series, which I was never really kind of able to get into because of like the dramatic parts of it. Like when they're trying to tell their story, like the documentary stuff, I think is amazing. But the other part, it just wasn't for me. They did an all out documentary on SpaceX, and particularly about launching the Falcon Heavy and launching it with the Roadster. And so it's available. I bought it. It was like $5 to buy it on like iTunes, whatever. So you can buy it as standalone. I think it's available to stream some places, but I really enjoyed it. It was a really cool inside. They played with the sequence of events of stuff, which I kind of thought like, well, this, I understand kind of narratively what you're doing, but this sort of lost some context there. But as far as insider access to SpaceX and see what's going on, I think that the Mars SpaceX, Inside SpaceX documentary is really good. Mm-hmm. Just realized that they took some things out of sequence and stuff. So you're like, wait, no, they did this thing before they did this thing, and you're watching a thing that's not the first time, blah, blah, blah. But anyhow, really enjoyed it.
So yeah, that it looks like that's from season two of the show called Mars. The episode is called Inside SpaceX.
Yep.
Very cool.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.